The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for June the 23rd. I'm Alok Char. Coming up on this week's show, we discuss energy policy, pollution and clean fuels with Bryony Worthington, environmental campaigner and founder of probably the most creative anti-climate change website around. Also in the podcast...
This case teaches us what has to go right in order for the body's immune system to successfully attack cancers.
We hear from leading oncologist Dr. Louis Wiener on how immunotherapy could hold the key to treating cancer. Plus, chimpanzees' sexual politics, the science behind screaming, and the secret to being a cad. Ding dong. It's all coming up on Science Weekly from The Guardian. I promised a packed pod this week, and what have I got? Podfather James Randerson is knee-deep in nappies, Bobby Johnson's given us the cold shoulder for Tech Weekly, and Nell Bose is probably on holiday or something. Ian Sample, quite frankly, I have no idea what Ian's up to. But the sole representative of the pod squad this week is The Guardian's environment correspondent, David Adam. David, are you feeling groovy?
Always, Alok, always.
Excellent. Now, David's here because we have a bit of a green tinge to this week's show, and indeed our special guest is Bryony Worthington. Bryony, welcome.
Thank you, Alok.
Bryony, and that's with two Ys, is a long-time environmental campaigner and recently the founder of sandbag.org.uk, a site that is quite frankly brilliant in the way that it seeks to bring about action on climate change. Bryony, why don't you give us a really short description of what people will find if they go to sandbag.org.uk?
Basically, Sandbag is a new way of engaging people in taking action on climate change. Basically, we're trying to provide something that people can feel they can make a real tangible difference. I think often when you think about climate change, it can be quite depressing. You feel quite alienated by the fact that there's not much you can do personally. And some of the actions you get told you can do, like switching off your lights and things like that, feel very small. And actually, there is a way that individuals can make a bigger difference, and that's through using the carbon market. So that's what we're trying to do, is engage people in the carbon market.
Now, it might seem like a strange thing to do for people because we've kind of all heard of carbon offsetting. So if you fly on a plane somewhere, you offset it by getting someone to plant trees or buy a stove somewhere that uses solar power instead of burning fossil fuels there in the developing world. Those kinds of things are available. Now, this goes a little bit, one step beyond all of that, by using the emissions trading scheme in Europe. Now, can you explain in less than 100 words what the emissions trading scheme is?
Okay, yes. Basically, it's a quite a clever form of regulation. So it puts laws into place that mean that no more than a certain level of emissions can actually take place. But it basically allows people to decide where those emissions occur by creating a market. So permits are created and given to installations that emit. And as long as you have enough permits to cover your emissions can go up and down. You just have to buy the permits to cover it. And there's a finite number of permits created. So basically, there's a price. There's a demand for permits and there's a price to pay for having them.
David, can I bring you in here just for a second? Who buys these permits normally? What are these permits normally used for?
Aren't they usually bought between companies? So if a big power station needs to produce more CO2 than it's permitted to, it can buy those spare permits from a company that isn't producing as much CO2 as it is allowed to.
And how much do they cost?
At the moment, the EU market is trading around 26, 27 euros a tonne. And a tonne is roughly one return flight to New York. Or
tonne of carbon dioxide.
Yeah, tonne of carbon dioxide, that's right. Yeah.
And across Europe, the idea is that this will eventually bring down carbon emissions by making it expensive to pollute. Is that the idea generally?
Yeah, it basically, the environmental impact is set by the caps, how the caps are set. Because it's a finite number of permits created, that's what determines how much environmental benefit comes from the scheme. So that's quite close to normal regulation. But the what's interesting about it is it's done through a traded system. So there's a price created for the right to pollute. And that price over time will rise. It will get more expensive to pollute. And that will mean people will invest in cleaner alternatives. And so money will start flowing into alternatives.
Okay, well, we can talk a bit more about how that the actual market is going to help climate change a little bit later. But let's talk about what Sandbag allows you to do. Now, the idea of markets and trading and everything, I mean, it doesn't sound like something that normal people can get involved in. You have to either be a massive power company with a huge coal-fired plant or something, or some industrial thing. But your website is aimed at bringing people together to actually do exactly that, to actually buy those credits.
Yeah, that's right. It was when the directive in the European Union was being created, they basically made sure that it was open to anyone to be able to buy these permits. And at the time, industry was saying, well, actually, we don't like that idea because people could just buy them and destroy them. But the legislation stayed as it was and the officials kept it so that anyone could get involved. So there's always been the opportunity for us to simply get involved, take those permits and destroy them. But no one as yet has really kind of reached out and tried to get a large volume of people to do that, to have an environmental impact.
And so the idea of destroying them is that it goes out of the system and in effect, you can pollute less. I mean, the Europe has less capability to pollute.
That's right. Fewer permits means fewer emissions, which means less risk of climate change.
So how does someone go about buying one of these permits?
Well, what we've done is we've registered ourselves as a participant in the scheme. It costs a couple of £100 to do that, and it's relatively time consuming. But now what we'll be doing is enable people to pay us to then buy credits on their behalf. You can do it yourselves. I mean, there's nothing stopping us. And actually, one of the messages we want to send out there is that this is something that anybody should and can do. And we ought to be, if we don't think the caps have been set tight enough, and it's fairly clear that they haven't been, then we should be trying to intervene and using our credit cards to make a difference.
David, is this, we mentioned carbon offsetting before, but and you've written about the way that people do that and whether it makes a difference or not. I mean, is this as good as carbon offsetting, or is it slightly better because it actually does actively reduce the amount we can pollute?
I think it's open to different interpretations. It might be interesting just to hear from Bryony. I know one of the criticisms people have had of buying these credits, the permits, is that there's just too many of them. And so, say, if Company X produces 100,000 tonnes of CO2, it's actually got enough permits to produce 110,000. And so it's got 10,000 to sell. So it would be perfectly happy for people to queue up and pay it good money to take those extra permits off its hands without denting its CO2 emissions.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's one part of the Sandbag campaign, which actually is to try. We're not really just interested in paying for these permits. We'd actually like to get them for free. And in order to do that, what we're going to do is create a map of all the installations. The map's already up there showing how much they emit each year and how many permits they have. And that will highlight where there's over-allocation. And then the idea is we create a kind of online community that applies pressure to those companies that are over-allocated and asks for them back. Because the thing about emissions trading is once you create these rights, you can't get them back. You either have to pay or you have to ask for them back. They're owned by the companies. So really, that's a big part of it, is to try and clean up that over-allocation, which has happened again in this phase. And So
you're not claiming that some offset companies do that you can erase the environmental damage, or you can cancel out the CO2 that someone would produce on a flight. It's more about awareness raising, and if we all do this enough, then it could make a difference.
Yeah, I share a lot of the cynicism about offsetting. I just don't think it's the right message to be sending. I think we all need to be reducing emissions, and this is another way we can do that. And we should be focusing on our personal actions, doing what we can. But this is another way of doing it from the comfort of your home with your credit card, and campaigning to make sure that this system works for the environment. It will probably work as an economic trading system. But is it delivering for the environment? That's what I'm interested in, and that's what I want to see happen. That's what Sandbag's about, is opening this thing, whole thing up to debate and making sure in the future we set the caps at the right levels.
Bryony, what this essentially is doing is exploiting, you wouldn't say it's a loophole, but it's kind of a loophole in the system. I mean, it's not meant for individuals really to buy this stuff, but you can. Is there any risk that the European system, the European legislators will just close this and say, actually, you've got to have a massive power station, you've got to be industry, you've got to have a certain rules before you can buy these things? Or they think, hang on a minute, these people are doing this, we can just create more credits.
You can't just create more credits because it's all been set up now, so it's just running until 2012. So there's no risk of that. I mean, yes, you might get a bit of industry lobbying saying this isn't fair, but the point is, if nobody wants to sell them to us, we can't buy them. So they have to be spare in order for us to buy
and
them.
For a price they want to sell.
And for a price they want to sell it. That's how a market works. And we're just creating extra demand. And someone's meeting that demand. It means the market's working. So there's no real theoretical reason why it shouldn't happen. I mean, if we're hugely successful, you'd have to be phenomenally successful to really, really cause price spikes. And what we're doing is really just exercising democratic right to intervene into this and say, we don't agree with the decisions that were taken. The cap should be tighter. There should be fewer permits in circulation. We want more action on climate change, and we're prepared to pay for it.
OK, we'll have more from Bryony a bit later on, but for the moment, let me point you in the direction of guardian.co.uk/environment. I'm Alok Jha, you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, we'll hear from a leading oncologist about how cancer treatment could be revolutionised by immunotherapy. First, though, here are some of the other stories making science headlines over the past 7 days. We're short on voices this week, so here's producer Ben and the video producer Rebecca with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Striking similarities between the brains of gay men and straight women have been discovered by neuroscientists, offering fresh evidence that sexual orientation is hardwired into our neural circuitry. Scans reveal homosexual men and heterosexual women have symmetrical brains, with the right and left hemispheres almost exactly the same size. The researchers also found that lesbians and straight men have asymmetrical brains, with the right hemisphere significantly larger than the left.
Sticking with neurology, the evolutionary mystery of why our faces contort when we're scared has been solved by a team of Canadian scientists. When our facial expression shifts to one of eye-bulging, nostril-flaring fear, our ability to sense attackers or other imminent danger improves dramatically. The findings lend support to the fight-or-flight theory laid out by Charles Darwin in one of his lesser-known works, The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, published in 1872.
A British team working in the forests of western Uganda have recorded the first evidence of sexual politics influencing the mating calls of our closest primate ancestors. And it sounds a bit like this. They found that chimps varied wildly in the extent of their calls during mating, but noticed a pattern that had never been spotted before. The researchers found that females were more vocal during sex if there were other high-ranking males around, but they toned down the noise significantly when aggressive females were nearby.
And finally, American psychologists claim to have found the recipe for a prolific sex life, or at least for men, and a certain type of man at that. Surveys of the sex lives and personalities of more than 35,000 people who took part in the study reveal what researchers call a dark triad of personality traits that appear to boost men's success with the opposite sex. Those subjects with more sexual partners and more short-term relationships tended to be narcissistic, self-obsessed, thrill-seeking, and display callous psychopathy and Machiavellian exploitation and deceitfulness. Works every time.
Didn't they do well? Now then, I promised you a bit of Ian Sample, and seeing as he wrote all of the stories we've just mentioned, I spoke to him a bit earlier on for a bit of a lowdown on each of them, starting with facial expressions.
Well, I think what was interesting was people had long thought that a lot of our facial expressions were really forms of communication, if you like. So a fear face, a face of disgust and such like would be kind of
like
commuting.
Like the one I'm doing now.
Like the one you're doing right now, yeah. Would be communicating information to other people in your pack, and I'm sure you do have a pack. These guys said, well, okay, that might be how these expressions are used now, but where did they actually come from? And why are they so similar across cultures? And Darwin even had this book, one of his sort of lesser well-known books, where he looked at the emotions and expressions of emotion among animals and humans, and he found similarities across the board. So what these guys did was some tests looking at how your sensory perception changes when you're pulling various faces. And essentially they looked at shock, fear and disgust. And fear being this expression where you open your eyes, you open your mouth, and you're far more attentive. Then the measurements they took showed that your field of range increases, the actual speed with which you saccade, the speed your eyes can scan at quickens. And also you can draw air into your body a lot quicker as well. And so this is sort of preparing yourself, being ultra vigilant, ready for the fight or flight.
So this is kind of explaining why a disgust face looks like it does, or a fear face looks like it does.
Exactly.
So you've explained why a fear face does what it does, and it makes sense, you know, get you ready for this fight or flight thing. What about the disgust face? Why that sort of sour, sucking lemons look?
Well, it's completely the other end of the spectrum, really. Whereas with fear, you're trying to heighten every perception. With disgust, let's pretend it's a bad smell for the want of anything else.
Again, we don't have to pretend in this.
You're screwing up your eyes. You're actually squeezing your nasal passages. These guys actually went to the effort of doing MRI scans of people pulling these faces, and they showed that the airflow through the nasal passages is far reduced because you're squeezing those. You're closing your mouth up. So you're shutting down enormously your sensory perception. So you can't smell these horrible things. You can't actually see things which you think are probably going to scar you, which is why we probably have those faces on quite a lot.
I love scientific research for that reason, for telling us about those sorts of things, and including the next result we're going to talk about, this gay men and heterosexual women have similarly shaped brains, research shows. I don't even know where to start with this. Do you have anything to say?
I think this is really interesting, actually. I don't think I'm...
How on earth do you report something like this without sort of headlines of gay men are women or that kind of terrible sort of thing? Which, by the way, it was quite carefully reported, but, it's...
I can imagine
people would just jump on this sort of research. Why would
it's... It's interesting because when a lot of brain research was originally done looking at the homosexual brain, the heterosexual brain, the lesbian brain, such like, a lot of people in various communities were very edgy about this and were thinking these scientists are looking for a way to cure this, or they're looking for a defect in the homosexual lesbian brain and such like. And that's really been out the window since 91, I think, if not before, when this guy Simon LeVay, himself a neuroscientist, homosexual guy on the west coast of the States, came out with one of the first studies on all of this, looking at changes in the brain. What these guys have done at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden is they've shown that the gay male brain is similar to a straight woman's brain in that the right and left hemispheres are the same size. Whereas if you look at a straight man's brain and a lesbian's brain, the right hemisphere is slightly but significantly larger. So it's about 2% larger in straight men, about 1% larger in lesbian women. Small changes, but there are other things in the wiring which these guys looked at as well. Some of the very basic wiring of your brain that was different also between these two groups. And I think this is really interesting. And talking to researchers in this field, it's not kind of one of those bits of research to roll your eyes at, really. I mean, there have been some studies before which have looked at how straight men and lesbian women have better spatial awareness, and that this is generally a right-hand side of the brain sort of function, whereas verbal fluency is more of a left-hand side of the brain.
What did the researchers say, if anything, about whether the asymmetry in the brain is the reason for, say, a woman becoming a lesbian, or because a woman's a lesbian, that's what those are the parts of the brain that grow or don't grow? One comes first?
It's no disrespect, but it's obviously the obvious question, and it's also the question they can't answer in this study, because they've looked at people who are, they were age-matched people, but they were 20s to 30s, and going on from there. And so you don't know whether, you can't say, at least from this study, whether these people's brains became symmetrical or asymmetrical depending on their sexual orientation already, or whether their sexual orientation is a result of this brain shape. Having said that, the people you speak to believe that this is probably something which happens in the womb, and that it is probably, if not in the womb, then shortly after, and it's probably to do with your exposure to sexual hormones like testosterone. But that isn't known yet.
Okay, well, given that this interesting result's been found, this asymmetry, what can researchers use this for? I mean, as you said, that the idea is not to cure or to diagnose, but it does still have some interesting aspects, doesn't it? Interesting sort of things that people can do with this information.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time talking to these researchers about whether they got any flack, misguided or otherwise, from people about doing this kind of research. And they were saying, well, look, the reason we do this is our whole group is set up to look for answers as to why there are differences in the psychiatric illnesses that men and women get, but also that gay and lesbian people have. And some of those differences are quite stark. Major depression is more severe and more persistent among females. Autism, obviously, we know is about four times more prevalent among boys than girls. And there are a whole range of other psychiatric disorders that and mental disorders that are in there, which have a very gender bias. And by understanding the female and male brain and the differences between those, and also with the gay and lesbian brains, then they are hoping to find out a bit more about what makes a certain brain susceptible to one condition, whereas another type of brain isn't.
So this is, recalls a bit of Simon Baron Cohen's work, really.
Absolutely, yeah. The extreme male brain,
male and female brains. That there's there are these extremes, and then everyone's sort of on a spectrum. Which is not to say that if you're a man, you have a woman's brain, or a man, or vice versa. But certainly there are things you can learn about.
Yeah,
this.
And I have to say, I had a curious number of emails from people I don't know asking if it would be possible for them to have their brain scanned to find out if they were gay or bisexual. And so it's quite interesting. You know, obviously the answer is no. You wouldn't be able to do something like that. And it's kind of a bit more worrying that people would even kind of want to do that.
They because think you if were people be able to scan if, their brains for them.
No, not me. But they wondered if were it possible.
Well, the Guardian MRI scanner. You know, I'm sure they could come down and we scan our brains all the time. Look, let's finish up with a story actually about you, Ian. Daniel Craig, sorry, Bond was in the headline of this piece. Bond has his wicked way with women because of a dark triad of personality traits. Now, I don't even know where that particular phrase came from, but what are these dark triads?
The dark triad is actually the phrase used by the researchers, and this was a couple of studies.
Is that a technical term, or...?
It depends whether you think that research is saying something once makes it a technical
like
term, and I think
triangle.
That's up
dark
for
triad.
Let's just describe what it is, and listeners can use their own terminology. But this was one of these studies where researchers send out loads of sort of questionnaires to people, and they went to if you combine the two studies, to more than 35,000 people in 57 countries, and they're asking people about their sexual history, their sexual preferences, and also about their personality traits. And it looked through the kind of what are known as the standard sort of five personality traits, neuroticism, sort of gregariousness, and things like this. What came back overwhelmingly from this was that there were three pretty nasty personality traits which seemed to combine to be quite a successful evolutionary strategy. And they were sort of this narcissistic self-obsession, a thrill-seeking kind of callous psychopathy, and this Machiavellian exploitation and deceitfulness. And the combination of those three, which is sort of classic in James Bond, is this sort of vaguely evil person who's extremely good at getting, in this case, women into
bed. James Bond isn't really evil, is he? He's more like he doesn't sort of care for the results of his actions when it comes to bad guys or bald people. But other than that...
He's
not evil, is he?
I agree, because the researcher was talking to me about Bond and how he fitted the bill, and I thought, well, actually, Bond's a goodie. Like
by
he's
every
a goodie.
He is,
yeah, right? So I mean, he's a womanizer as well, though.
But
so
even his womanizing's, lauded by society, it seems.
You know what the interesting question is here, though?
What is it?
Is why do women go for these men?
Because they're bastards. We've known that for a long time. If you read Cosmo,
that's not an answer. That's saying they go for them because they go for them.
Okay, why is it then?
Well, I say it's an interesting question.
Oh,
this is where
the
research goes next.
You don't know the answer.
I don't know the answer.
But no, but as your piece ends with this phrase, you know, why do women go for bastards? Well, I'm glad to see that science has proved that that's actually true as well.
Science proves the obvious, isn't it?
Do you fit the dark triad in?
Of course not.
Not even in your...
I'm not vaguely evil. Teletubbies are vaguely evil.
Not even when you're in the films doing your sort of stunts and stuff. No?
Just leave that.
How is the new film, by the way? Okay, he doesn't want to answer that question. Obviously bound by some sort of contract. Thanks, Ian.
Science Weekly.
Now, I think that worked rather seamlessly. To post your thoughts on any of those stories, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or post something on the Facebook wall. One of the most amazing stories of the past 7 days was the news that a patient whose skin cancer had spread throughout his body had been given the all clear after being injected with billions of his own immune cells. Tests revealed that the 52-year-old man's tumours, which spread from his skin to his lung and groin, vanished within 2 months of having the treatment and had not returned 2 years later. Doctors in Seattle, led by Cassian Yee, attempted the experimental therapy as part of a clinical trial after the man's cancer failed to respond to conventional treatments. While it all sounds amazing, and earlier I spoke to Dr. Louis Wiener. He's one of the world's leading oncologists and wrote a piece on using immunotherapy for treating cancer in the most recent edition of the New England Journal of Medicine.
The Yee group did a very interesting series of studies designed to improve immunotherapy for cancer. And based upon their preclinical work, they devised a clinical trial that was designed to mobilize the body's immune system to attack melanoma. They chose melanoma because it's one of the few cancers where there's a good understanding of the targets that the immune system elements recognize to cause tumor destruction in some cases. And the approach that they employed built upon work that had been done by other investigators in the past. Previously, it had been shown that when patients with melanoma are treated with high doses of an immune system hormone called interleukin-2, these patients would occasionally have very remarkable and durable complete remissions of their cancers that appear to be, in some cases, curative. However, this happens quite rarely. Investigators at the National Cancer Institute, led by a scientist named Stephen Rosenberg, were able to identify that in the patients who had outstanding clinical outcomes, that T cells of the body's immune system had infiltrated the tumors, and these T cells were likely responsible for the immune attack. They then made the interesting and somewhat remarkable observation that if they were to eliminate the patient's own lymphocytes by giving them chemotherapy prior to giving the T cells, that the T cells found it easier to expand in the patient's body, and they were able to essentially then filter into the tumor sites and cause tumor regressions.
In a sense, in this particular experiment, this cloning of the body's own immune cells is interesting for two reasons. Well, one, because it's sort of amping up the body's own ability to attack the tumor, but also there's no risk of rejection, so that's obviously an advantage.
The problem with the Rosenberg approach was that it's reasonably toxic and it's unpredictable. Patients are subjected to aggressive chemotherapy. They are also treated after they get the T cells with high doses of interleukin-2 that can cause toxicity. What the Yi group did was to take a slightly different tack. And they reasoned that instead of delivering only the tumor-specific T cells and going through the complex technologies that were required to get to raise the large number of T cells that were required, they just took blood cells from patients with melanoma. They then exposed those cells to the known melanoma targets that the immune system can recognize, and these are called antigens. And then they isolated out the CD4 positive T cell compartment. And CD4 cells are the T cell compartment that appear to be orchestrating the immune response. And they felt that if they just gave back the CD4 cells that had been educated to react with the melanoma targets, that those CD4 cells would know what to do, that they would know how to get to the tumor cells, and when they got to the tumors, they would know how to orchestrate the immune response and bring in all the diverse elements that were required to eliminate the cancer.
This experiment was done on skin cancer, melanoma. How confident are you that it can transfer to other cancers? And more generally, how excited are you that this is going to be an important way to tackle cancers in the future?
I think that melanoma provides an early peek into how we might develop these treatments in the future, because we know so much more about the antigens that are tasty to the immune system. In other cancers, we have not as many good clues about how the immune system recognizes and rejects cancers. So I believe melanoma is giving us information that will be useful and will initially be more specific for melanoma. But as we understand more about the repertoire of antigens that the body's immune system recognizes and can be mobilized as rejection targets, we'll be able to extend this into other cancers as well.
Louis Wiener there. You can read more on that story at guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Okay, well, Bryony Worthington has been sitting very patiently. I wanted to talk a bit more, Bryony, about the future. The issue with this round of the European trading scheme has been that the actual permits have been free. The companies themselves don't have to pay. So it's actually doubly galling to have to pay that they've got 10,000 extra and they can sell them and make money out of them. The next time round, 2013, when the next phase starts, what happens then? What's different about that?
Then it starts to move to an auctioning system. And to my mind, Sandbag is not really being set up with a view to being an NGO that carries on forever. We want to do a good job over the next 5 years of making sure that emissions trading starts to work for the environment here and everywhere else, actually, because it's cropping up all over the world and there's not enough public scrutiny anywhere being applied. So in 5 years' time, ideally, Sandbag's done its job, it's closed down, emissions trading's working, everyone's paying for their permits, and hopefully we're starting to see big reductions and big investment into cleaner technologies.
But do you want to leave behind a sort of community of nerds who monitors the ETS trading scheme and sort of make sure that nothing untoward happens or intervenes whenever it fancies, especially rich nerds?
Yeah, absolutely. The ideal would be, you know, Sandbag in China, where they're bound to be by then setting up their own trading scheme, and that will need a lot of scrutiny.
Well, that was my next question. What happens internationally? I mean, the European trading scheme, for all its ills, is at least an attempt to address carbon emissions in Europe. There isn't anything anywhere else. A recent study by MIT looked at the ETS and said that actually there's lots of things wrong with this, but it's better than nothing. And it's, you know, it's actually encouraging to see that this is starting in the first place. What's happening in the rest of the world in terms of trying to put caps on these sorts of emissions? I mean, we're not talking Kyoto level agreements or anything, but just this,
no,
locally,
these sort of company level trading schemes. Yeah, they're being talked about in other countries. So Australia's planning to introduce an economy wide cap and trade scheme. New Zealand's thinking of doing the same. There's lots of debate in Japan. They may well move to this system. In the US, they've got state level schemes already being planned and starting to launch. But there's moves towards creating a federal cap and trade system. And they'll all go through the same teething pains that the European one has, which is industry will want more permits, government will try to keep industry happy and hand out, you know, a balance between what they think's right for the environment, what they think the industry needs, and it needs public involvement to make sure that the environment, you know, gets a fair hearing in that debate.
David, can you put some of this trading scheme stuff into context with global negotiations around carbon emissions? So there's going to be a massive meeting next year in Copenhagen to sort of agree some sort of post-Kyoto agreement. Are trading schemes a part of that, or are they completely different? What other kinds of mechanisms are there to sort of cap these emissions around the world?
I think trading schemes are seen as one of the major routes, and that's because, in a way, you can think of it as a different sizes of gears on an engine, in the way that the European economy could be capped. Well, it already is capped in the emissions trading scheme. Now, you could set up a similar trading scheme within China, for example, and Chinese steel companies could maybe start to trade between themselves, or Chinese energy companies. And then ultimately, this is a slightly visionary idea, but they have talked about being able to then link up the different trading stream, different trading schemes. And so you sort of get round some of the international friction in that the US and China are on a par economically. And so how on earth would you trade between those companies in those different countries in a fair way? But if you assume that all American companies are at least starting on a similar playing field and all Chinese companies are on a similar playing field to each other, and then it's sort of a commonality. So it's a way that everyone can be seen to be doing the right thing and in a similar way. But actually, you can, as I said, you can set it on different gears. And so each part of the world can sort of do its own thing within a wider framework. Mm. Does that make sense?
What's your call on that?
You know, I think the way it will evolve is that you will get different trading schemes set up, as David said, to take into account the circumstances of that country. But there'll be links between them, and it'll be a bit like the currency markets, where you'll get different priced carbon in different markets, and there'll be exchange rates between them that enable, you know, globally finances to flow to the places it needs to go. So, yeah, it'll be like a new currency market in carbon.
This is a really stupid question, but I thought I should ask because I've got two environment-type experts here. How does anyone check that if you've got a permit to emit 10,000 tonnes of carbon, you only emit 10,000 tonnes of carbon?
It's all the responsibility of the environmental regulators in each country. So our environmental regulators are the Environment Agency. They've been checking up on pollutant levels for years. I mean, they've started looking at sulfur and particulates and other pollutants. And it's the same system, basically. It's a reporting system that's then verified, and there are spot checks and big fines if you're out of if you're found to be non-compliant. So it's you know, something Europe does quite well is kind of environmental end of pipe regulation, and so it's all done through that same system.
You know, this might be quite complicated, but it's actually quite a positive environmental story for the first time. I don't know how long. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science to find links to all the stories we've discussed. And if you want to post something, then do it on our Facebook wall. We're back next week with a special show devoted to CERN, large hadron colliders, and big physics. It's going to be epic. For now, though, my very special thanks to David Adam and, of course, Bryony Worthington for coming in and being our guest this week. Find out more about what she's doing at sandbag.org.uk. And if you don't get involved, I'll get my brother on you. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.